Whoever is not strenuous is lazy, even though he is generous and possess all other qualities. He can neither realize the good and the wholesome, work to benefit others, nor attain enlightenment. So this is how Gampopa introduces chapter 15 of the Jewel Ornament of Liberation, which deals with Virya Paramita, which can be translated as the perfection of strenuousness, or the perfection of effort, or the perfection of energy, or the perfection of diligence. Virya literally means the state of being a strong man. So Virya refers to this whole area of strength, effort, energy, potency. It refers to that whole territory. All qualities come from Virya. If you want knowledge, love, compassion, enlightenment, you need to make effort. You need to be able to make effort. Enlightenment, it said, isn't difficult if you have energy, if you have Virya. Enlightenment is easy, Gampopa quotes from a Buddhist text, for the hard working. Enlightenment is easy for the hard working. So, of course, the path to enlightenment for all beings requires tremendous energy and strength and effort. And then Gampopa describes the essence of Virya, the essence of Virya, which he defines as striving for the good and the wholesome. Striving for the good and the wholesome. Striving to cultivate skillful states of mind. Striving for skillful action. So states of mind free of ill will, aversion, craving, clinging, confusion, ignorance. Striving to be free of those things. More positively, striving towards the positive, the good, capital G. Cultivating friendliness, love, sympathetic joy, equanimity, clarity, generosity, wisdom, and so on. If you wanted to really boil it all down, one Buddhist writer calls Virya energy in pursuit of the good. Not good with a small g, big G, good. Energy in pursuit of the good. As we'll see, it's not just any old energy that's being talked about here. And Virya counteracts especially laziness. For laziness, Gampopa says, is detrimental to enlightenment. There's no laziness in a Buddha, in an enlightened being. And when you look at the Buddha's life, you have an impression of unremitting energy. Even when he was a very old man, when his body was broken, he was very seriously ill. He kept making effort, or more like he just had the energy, spiritual energy, if you like, to go on a great last tour to see his disciples and keep teaching until his last breath. At the same time, and I think this is important, the Buddha could do nothing. He could sit still and do absolutely nothing. And again, in his last days, there's a beautiful passage where the Buddha is sitting in a grove of very ancient trees in Vaishali. And he's just telling Ananda how delightful these ancient groves of Vaishali are. And he's just sitting there. Just sitting there. Well, there's still energy there. There's still energy in that just sitting. In fact, the Buddha's effort, the effort in enlightenment, is called the bliss of effort. The bliss of effort. It's just free-flowing energy. So it's not rushing around frantically out of anxiety. Virya is not that kind of willful effort, even for the unenlightened. You can be sitting doing nothing, and you can be making effort. And you do that when you meditate. You sit relaxed and calm, and turning the mind to the good and the wholesome, well, that's making effort. You can do that just sitting in an armchair, just sitting doing nothing. That can be making an effort. If you're involved in skillful, creative, contented states, well, that's Virya. So we mustn't get the idea that Virya is rushing around frantically. But just in case, having said that, we start turning effort into laziness, very easy to hijack that. Oh, Virya is doing nothing. Let's look at the way Gampopa speaks of laziness. And he speaks of three kinds of laziness. The First of all, the laziness of lassitude. Secondly, the laziness of faint-heartedness. And thirdly, gross laziness. So firstly, lassitude. And Gampopa describes this as addiction to the pleasures of letting the mind drift through lounging about and being addicted to sleep and dreaminess. So you're just letting the mind drift along and you're just kind of lounging around and you're just addicted to sleep and dreaminess. So it's just a dull, inert state. You're just closed down. It's not a healthy tiredness, this. You know, that healthy rest after work. And that's an aspect of virya. Resting skillfully after work. So this is a state of kind of habitual dullness. It's dreamy as well. You know, you're very dull and you lie around and you loll around. But of course you also have wonderful plans about the novels you're going to write and how you're going to change the world and all the things you will do. But you're just dreaming. You're just dreaming. And you have to be careful if you're into this that you don't have what Sangharakshita calls a great future behind you. Gampopa recommends as an antidote to this reflecting on death to shock you out of that state. You know, you just need to be sort of shocked out of it. And we notice sometimes when we're feeling dull, I haven't got any energy. If we're suddenly presented with something very challenging, suddenly we're wide awake and alert. Suddenly there's energy, there's readiness. Well, that is actually our situation all the time. We are all the time facing impermanence. That's our situation. But having said that, I think if we suffer from this sort of dullness and inertia, we might have to look at other things as well. And I put these broadly under the area of exercise. Well, physical exercise for a start. Do we use the body? Sometimes we haven't got energy because we just don't take exercise. We don't go for walks. We don't do things like yoga and running and all that sort of thing. The body does need to move. Obviously, it depends on our state of health and all that sort of thing. But the body does need to be used and moved. We also need to pay attention to our health, diet, that kind of thing. Maybe that's why we don't have energy. You know, we're just not, you know, looking after ourselves in the right kind of way. And I think productive work. You know, if we're dull, maybe we're not working. Maybe we're not actually doing something. Just getting stuck in, getting our hands dirty. Well, that's important. Do we have too much time on our hands? Sometimes people don't have any energy because, well, they've just got too much time on their hands, you know, and they actually need to, you know, kind of get up and do something. But also, does one's life have purpose and meaning? I think perhaps, you know, that comes up as well. Is that, you know, do we really have a sense of our purpose and meaning? And then there's things like mental exercise. I think this dullness can be, you know, addressed by, well, are we kind of reading? Are we thinking? Do we engage in kind of decent conversation? Emotional exercise. Well, what are the state of our emotions like? Are they sort of congealed and dull and stuck and just habitually kind of getting stuck? You know, are we actually alive emotionally? And that whole brings up the whole area of real good, deep, stimulating communication, warm communication with others. So we've got to, I think if we suffer from dullness, we might have to look at these sorts of areas. If this dull state starts to come over us, Gampopa, quoting a Buddhist text, says, you should throw it off as if it were a serpent that had crawled into your lap. It's as dangerous as that. Sometimes we just don't see how perilous our situation is, this lazy, passive, dull state. It's not actually a neutral state. It's not a neutral space, you know. It's actually, it's just draining us, actually, of our qualities and our potential. It's like a great boa constrictor squeezing the life out of us. I mean, I think, you know, I mean, if we've been into, you know, like dope smoking, and we still are, that kind of thing, that kind of territory, well, this is the kind of dullness that you can end up getting into. And I think that's an area that really, if you have energy problems, well, have a look at that area as well. I don't know if anybody does get up to that sort of thing, but it's worth mentioning it. It does have consequences. The second kind of laziness is being faint-hearted. We get into moods where, says Gampopa, we think, how can dejected people like myself ever attain enlightenment, even if we try to do so? Well, you know how it is. I mean, you can feel his sympathy here. I know he's hardcore as a Buddhist, but you know, he's got some understanding of our situation. You know how it is. It happens. You meditate day after day, and it's just wall-to-wall distraction. You know, in the Metta Bhavana, it's just blank, or you're overwhelmed with kind of, you know, you're just so pissed off with somebody and you can't get them out of your head, and your knees ache. You hardly retain anything that you've studied. You know, you've heard the Dharma tapes and you've read the books and you can't remember anything. And life is very difficult sometimes, and those other Buddhists, they're really awful, aren't they? And, you know, and you start thinking, well, I can't do this, you know. It's just not possible. Buddhism's great, but I can't do it, you know. I know the Buddha says everybody can, but I can't. I'm that unique, special person that can't do it. So Gampopa says, to counter this, these moods of faint-heartedness that come over us, take heart, because the Buddha has said that even a fly, a wasp, a bee, even a worm can gain enlightenment. Now, please don't get all metaphysical about this, and when you're in the groups, well, have worms got Buddha nature? Well, sometimes, I think it's being very simple, sometimes we feel like a worm, don't we, or a fly, you know, something like that. I mean, I do. Sometimes, I don't know about you, we feel small and insignificant and there's not much going for us. But Gampopa says, look, reflect like this. Actually, why should I not attain enlightenment? I am a human being. I know what's useful and I know what's harmful. So I won't give up. That's great, isn't it? He's saying, you know, I know what to do. I know what works and I know what doesn't. That's all you need to know. You don't need anything more than that. So of course I can make spiritual progress. Sometimes I think we just don't see, we don't recognise the progress that we've made and that we're actually making. Our standards sometimes can be far too high. So we don't actually see the growth in awareness and ordinary friendliness. You know, we've got these great high standards, you know, that in every meditation, you know, it should be stream entry or something like that. It's a bit like watching Shane Warne, the Australian spin bowler. Every ball he wants a wicket. And he can't believe it when he doesn't get a wicket. Well, it can be like that with our spiritual practice. We just can't believe it when, you know, when we fail. There's a great American poet named William Stafford who wrote a poem every day. Every day when he, from a very young age, he wrote a poem, and he continued that throughout his life. And in a seminar one day, he was asked, well, you know, what happens when, you know, what do you recommend when I feel I can't write the poem? I don't feel like writing the poem. And William Stafford said, lower your standards. Lower your standards. And I thought that was a brilliant reply. Metta Bhavana. Okay, maybe it is not a fantastic, all-encompassing loving kindness that just flows naturally. But hey, just try to hold yourself and other people in awareness. Just attend to them. And if you can't do that, just sit there. Relaxed, without moving. Just sit there, just stay there. And don't, without any expectation, just do that. That is an achievement, just to stop. A friend of mine, a very, very senior order member, he has real trouble with meditation, but he says, I think it's good just to sit still for an hour every day. And that's kind of his practice. And you can see the effects of it, you know, on him. Mindfulness of breathing. You forget which number you're on. You fall asleep. You're distracted. You're away with the fairies. Don't get down. Just sit there. It's an achievement just to sit for 40 minutes or whatever it is without moving. Open your eyes if necessary. Just learn to relax and be with yourself. Without expectation. Those other qualities in meditation will come. So lower your standards. Okay, in the background, you know, we've got, you know, a great vision of enlightenment that can inspire us. But that's the backdrop. That's the landscape. You know, the actual thing we attend to, we do what we can. And what we can is actually a lot. And obviously, spiritual friends are very important here. You know, to encourage us. I like this word, encourage. You know, courage is instilled in us, as it were. So a good spiritual friend keeps relating to the good in us, even when we feel we can't see it. I remember once I happened to be on the telephone to Sangharakshita, our teacher. I was having to just looking after the phone here one day, I think, and he phoned up. He wanted to talk to somebody about something, but he asked me how I was getting on, and I said, well, I just feel sometimes, you know, Bhante, that progress is so, I mean, nothing seems to be happening. It's so slow. It's just infinitesimal, you know. It's just, you know, I was a bit faint-hearted. And he just kept saying, no, measurable, measurable, measurable. And he kept saying it, measurable. Very, very interesting. Thirdly, gross laziness. And here we have one of the most famous paragraphs in the Jewel Ornament of Liberation. Gross laziness is addiction to such evil and unwholesome practices as subduing enemies and hoarding money. They have to be given up because they are the cause of real suffering. So we might put a lot of energy into fighting others, competing with others in business, in politics, in life. We might put a lot of energy into making money and saving it up. There's a lot of energy in these things, in industry and business and politics and all the rest of it. But that is not virya. That is not virya. It's not virya because it's not for the purpose of liberation from suffering. In fact, it's increasing suffering. So that is laziness. So this reminds us that virya is skillfully directed energy. So let's then turn to the nature of virya. And again, Gampopa's exploration of this is very thorough. It's only in a few pages in the chapter on virya, but there are a lot of headings and subheadings. So again, I'll just mention the things that have struck me. And the first thing he mentions is motivation. Having an excellent motivation. And he explains this in a very traditional way, but which will sound a bit strange to us. He talks a bit following tradition, putting on the armour. Here's the quotation. Putting on the armour of energy in pursuit of the good, with the intention of wearing it until all sentient beings turn towards enlightenment. I mean, to me, putting on armour isn't an entirely attractive image, I have to say. You know, buckling on a sort of heavy metal armour and sort of clanking around, rigid and stiff like a crusader. It's not, I mean, it doesn't do it for me, you know, the knights and all that sort of thing. Perhaps we need to think of ancient Indian armour or Tibetan armour, which is a far lighter and flexible affair. Allowing for great mobility. Maybe we need to think of that. When he explains what the armour is that you put on, you get a better idea of what he's evoking. And he quotes an ancient text where the Buddha says to his disciple Shariputra, Shariputra, put on the armour of unfathomable loving kindness and do not relax your energy so that the most insignificant in samsara may come to enlightenment. He also quotes a text which says that this armour of unfathomable loving kindness gathers beings to you. And since beings are infinite, so must be the armour. The armour must be infinite. So the armour is not something rigid that cuts you off and encases you. It's more like the protection given by very deep loving kindness. Loving kindness that stems from a real insight into the true nature of life. This armour is the magical protective energy of bodhicitta, the heart and mind intent on wisdom and loving kindness. And to do the bodhisattva work, you need to be in touch with that kind of energy, that kind of protective energy, if you like, of loving kindness and wisdom. Later on, Gampopa speaks about virya and as ever ready, ever active. So I relate this to this business about putting on the armour. We need to rouse our latent spiritual energies, if you like, and be protected by them. There's something perhaps rather mysterious here, and I think it isn't very easy to speak of. You can practice Buddhism in a very dedicated way, you're very steady, very clear about it, and that's very important to establish that regular spiritual practice, that steady engagement. But something can be missing. And what's missing is a certain kind of spark. You haven't somehow sparked off a deep enough level of vitality and energy. And very often this sparking off, this opening up of energy, is associated with communication with a spiritual friend, someone in whom the energy of the bodhicitta is alive, so to speak. Contact with them sort of sparks you. And there's a release of energy that just runs and runs, that is very runs and runs, that is also a great protection to you. I suppose this idea of armour is a bit like you're creating a sort of aura, a kind of protective aura has been kind of sparked off. You remember that when I talked about Gampopa's life, I mean, he steadily engaged, you know, got very far practicing within his monastery for 5 years, and then he has these dreams of this blue-tinged yogi with the long hair and the cotton robe. And then when he meets Milarepa, there's a dramatic change. Yes, he needed that steady engagement beforehand, but then there's this release of tremendous spiritual energy, and he becomes a great teacher. So without this deep energy drawing on the profoundest loving-kindness, bodhisattva practice is impossible, actually. It would just descend into willed effort and good works and exhaustion and burnout. So we need to be drawing on something very deep for the bodhisattva work. So Gampopa also speaks of virya applied to work. Okay, so your energies are sparked off, but then you need to apply them to particular tasks. You need to apply them to spiritual practices like meditation. To purify and transform klesha, the inner poison drives. You need to apply your virya to benefit others in whatever way is needed. And I mentioned the different ways that we could do that when I spoke of generosity, dana paramita. And what you're looking for is a joyful energy and a joyful engagement with the work, and an eager and prompt engagement with the work. So virya, really what you're looking for is a joyful and eager work to benefit others. In fact, at the highest level, this is seen as play, as fun. You enjoy it, even when it's very, very demanding and tough, you still see it as play. And this comes when you see everything as a wonderful creative display, brilliant and vivid, with no solid substance. No matter how difficult and painful things are, you can still joyfully engage with what's happening. On a lower level, we have to find a way of connecting joyfully with our deepest sense of purpose, and discovering real interest and fascination with what we're involved in, and develop curiosity with what we're involved with. It's very important in meditation in this respect. Trying to find interest in the practice, trying to become fascinated in the practice. When you do that, your energy naturally flows into the spiritual practice. Even becoming curious, fascinated with the difficulties that are there. So what you're looking for in the end is finding a way of naturally putting a lot of energy and effort into things, even when you don't feel like doing so. There's a kind of deeper energy that you can call on. And Gampopa quotes a text which says, "A bodhisattva plunges into his different tasks as if he were an elephant, joyfully plunging into a lake in the midday heat." Well, if you've ever seen an elephant I've seen an elephant plunging into a river in the midday heat, you'll know what joy there is in that. So that's the kind of engagement that we need to have. So in speaking like this, it's clear that we need to go very deep indeed to be able to call upon, to be sustained by this quality of energy. So of course we need to train in the perfection of meditation and the perfection of wisdom. These are the last two perfections. So first of all, we're going to have a look at the perfection of meditation, Dhyana Paramita. And Gampopa says at the beginning of chapter 16, which deals with this, "He who does not practice meditation, though he be generous and possess all other qualities, falls into the power of restlessness, and his mind is wounded by the fangs of the defilements." Without meditating, we have a restless and scattered mind. We're unable to focus. We also have a poisoned mind, poisoned by cravings, aversions, confusions. And because of that, we cannot develop the higher knowledge. We cannot, in fact, develop the wisdom that leads to liberation. And without that, we will not have the true and genuine compassion to help others to liberation. So Gampopa quotes again from an ancient text, "When the workings of the mind have become harmonized, one sees things according to their true nature. A bodhisattva then becomes steeped in great compassion for sentient beings." So this leads Gampopa into a discussion of the two great aspects of meditation. The cultivation of shamatha, which can be translated as calm, tranquility, and vipassana, which can be translated as clear seeing of things as they really are. And these need to be fully integrated. We need to have this calm, tranquility, and this great clarity. But before that, he speaks about the context in which meditation practice takes place. Gampopa, of course, is speaking to monks or very serious lay people. So he says that to meditate successfully, you have to remove yourself from all your usual attachments, from family and possessions, and you need to go into retreat for a while, for a time. We're so bound up with things and people, how can we be calm and how can we see things as they are? As Gampopa says, when one is attached to beings, reality remains obscured. You know, we can't see things clearly because we've got so much caught up with other people. So we need to simplify things. We need to be free of things if we're going to successfully meditate. That's why we ask you when you come on retreat to put away the mobiles, the iPods, the computers, all the rest of it. Just to get away from all that stuff and simplify. If you're on a meditation retreat, if this was a full meditation retreat, well, you'd be getting right away completely and there'd be a lot of silence and you'd be simplifying right down. But if we're a beginner to meditation, we need to take great care with this. It's possible to be too intense too soon, and that can create problems. We need to be working at first when we take up a meditation practice on creating a congruence between our ordinary life, what we do in our ordinary life, and our meditation. We need to slowly and gradually build up our meditation practice. In fact, before kind of going away doing intensive meditation retreats, we need to actually to establish a daily meditation practice. Meditation is not about having intense, fantastic, mind-blowing experiences. Those things can be just a massive distraction, actually. What meditation is about is building up a steady engagement with generating skillful states, awareness and metta and so on. That's what we need to be establishing in our life, when we're sitting on the cushion and when we're off it. So first, we need to develop a simple daily practice. Meditating at the same time every day, wherever you are. And then when you're at home, not just at the same time, trying to meditate in the same place. Have an actual special place where you meditate. And to begin when you're developing a practice, begin with short periods of meditation, not great big long ones, 20 minutes, even less if necessary. And associate, this is a very important point that Sangharakshita makes, start associating meditation with pleasure. That's why he recommends to begin short periods of sitting, so that you associate it with something comfortable and pleasurable. Don't try to sort of tough out great long meditations. To begin with, just build it up very slowly and gently, and work on the other aspects of life so that there's a congruence between your sitting and your life. In time, maybe you build up to longer periods of meditation, maybe you meditate twice a day. In time, you go on an intensive meditation retreat. Maybe this is something with the coming year you can sort of think a bit about your meditation practice, how you can sort of develop this steady engagement. I won't say it's no good, because nothing's no good, but I think it's not entirely helpful to, you know, like have intensive bursts where you're meditating, you know, very intensively, and then you don't meditate for weeks on end. I don't think that's a good way of approaching things. Get a bit weird doing that. Anyway, so build up, establish a daily practice in that way. But Gampopa says, go away to meditate if you want to be successful. And that will begin to calm the mind. But then go deeper, begin to work on the mind. In particular, you need, he says, to deal with the hindrances and poisons that fracture and dissipate the mind. You know, we can't see things as they are because the mind is so fractured and dissipated. So what you are looking for is what Gampopa describes as the essence of meditation. This is the essence of meditation. Tranquility, by which mind abides within itself by the oneness of the good and the wholesome. Or another definition, oneness of mind, the indwelling of mind with the good. This term oneness, this is Herbert Gunter's translation, is a translation of the Sanskrit ekagrata, which is usually translated as one-pointedness of mind. But I really like this oneness of mind, this oneness of consciousness. One-pointed could sound a bit sort of willful. It's just sort of aspect of your mind concentrating. What you're looking for is this oneness in the mind, this tranquility, this indwelling of the mind with the good and the wholesome. So the aim is to have this calm, peaceful, deeply harmonious mind, heart, consciousness, dwelling in good and wholesome states. This is what we're doing in the metta and the mindfulness of breathing. You know, they're states of friendliness and loving kindness and awareness, and we're just trying to pervade our mind with those qualities so that there is a kind of oneness and harmony within the mind. The mind is fully harmonious and integrated around that. And of course, when you do start entering this, it becomes deeply pleasurable and expansive. And you do become very absorbed, you know, concentrated in the best sense. In the sense of the coming together of all the aspects of our being into a harmonious whole. And there's not one state of shamatha, of calm. There's a range of ever-deepening, expanding states of being, and these are called dhyana, absorptions. We don't meditate to get these experiences. We meditate, in fact, without expectation. We deal with what's there. And what's there, very often, is one or other of the poisons. Craving, ill will, bewilderment, envy, conceit, confusion, sloth and torpor, etc. And these disturb the mind and they create disintegration. So Gampopa describes particular meditation practices to address these particular poisons. And I have to say that some of these practices, I'm not going to mention them because they're very strong medicine. And I think most people in the West would, I'm almost certain to misunderstand them. So I don't personally think they're advisable. But among them, he does mention, Gampopa does mention, the mindfulness of breathing and the metta bhavana. And I must say that from my experience, these need to be the foundation of all meditation practice. Becoming established in mindfulness and awareness and friendliness a generally positive approach to life. That really is the foundation, I think, of all spiritual practice. And actually, if you took those two aspects to their depth, you'd arrive at wisdom and compassion. You'd arrive at bodhicitta. Having said that, the fact that Gampopa mentions a number of different methods of meditation makes it clear that methods of meditation are a means to an end. This is very important. You know, sometimes you can read or you can hear people claiming, well, this meditation technique, this is the real quick path. This is the only way to kind of, you know, get you into enlightenment. Well, it's not quite like that. Any method of meditation is a means. It's not an end in itself. The aim of meditation, first of all, is to establish that oneness of mind, that indwelling with the good and the wholesome. And we have to find our way, the way in which that's effective for us at any given time to do that. Another way you could look at this is that meditation is about creating a stream, a flow of wholesome and creative states of being. Whether you're sitting on the meditation cushion or whether you're off it. Sangharakshita says that defines meditation as the uninterrupted stream of skillful states. So as the bodhisattva deepens his meditation, deepens his practice, his oneness of mind, his absorption, this develops into three different aspects. So Gampopa mentions, first of all, meditation that brings tangible well-being here and now. Secondly, meditation that gives rise to good qualities. And thirdly, meditation that benefits others. So the first aspect of a bodhisattva's meditation is meditation that brings tangible well-being and makes one a suitable vessel for further development. This state of mind makes the mind broad and deep and at ease and flexible and has various qualities. And I'm going to mention these qualities because I think it's worth trying to notice these qualities in your own meditation, noticing the seeds of these qualities when you sit. Just notice them. They might be there, that their latency might be there. Of course, if you develop them, they'll grow into something very deep and rich. So first of all, a bodhisattva's meditation is free of all discursive thought. There's no commentary going on. And most of the time our mind is just a stream of stuff, you know, commenting. I mean, going on a solitary meditation retreat, I mean, I am appalled by the stuff, just the chatter. I mean, advertising jingles from the 1960s. I mean, where does it come from? I mean, just... Yeah, well, I know where it comes from. It comes from my greedy ears. But just rattling along. In meditation, there's this deep silence when you get deeply into it. The space between thoughts starts to open up. And in particular, you don't have any ideas about existence or non-existence. That the meditation is this or that. You're not even having thoughts. There's no subtle commentary about the meditation itself. So thought has dropped away. And this isn't a blank space, of course. This is a deep silence that opens up. And it's very pleasurable. Secondly, body and mind relaxed. There's no tension anywhere in a bodhisattva's meditation. There's no tension from unskillful states. Unskillful states create tension. They create conflict in us. Well, they've gone. So the body and mind is relaxed. There's ease. There's lightness. And there's a kind of mastery, they talk, a natural mastery in this. You're sort of, as it were, master of yourself. But it's so light. Some descriptions, they speak of... you feel sometimes in meditation, you're so relaxed. It's so light. You're like... You know, a bit of cotton down or thistle down, just floating through space. Thirdly, third aspect of a bodhisattva's meditation, supremely peaceful in the best way. And what this means is that you're naturally in this state. You've done the work of meditation, the effort to engage in a particular practice. But when meditation is really happening, You're not doing anything. It's happening of itself. This is why, by the way, the just sitting meditation that you're doing every morning and you'll be doing a bit tomorrow is so important, because, and from what Padmadaka tells me, he's not telling you anything about it. He's not filling that space. It's really important that there's just this open space, learning, as it were, learning through your being to develop, as it were, the natural, or for there to arise the natural aspect of meditation, where you, as it were, just learn to enjoy the fruits without trying to enjoy the fruits of the effort that you've made. Fourthly, when you dwell in when a bodhisattva dwells in meditation, he is without conceit. There's no hint of, I am the meditator, I am the great one, I am meditating. There's none of that. That's all vanished. It sometimes can happen. You start getting into, it's coming together. You know, yes, I'm getting concentrated. The love's beginning to flow. The juices are going. You think, whoa, I'm a meditator. And then, of course, it collapses and you're kind of on the floor, you know, metaphorically speaking. So there's no conceit in a bodhisattva's meditation. Fifthly, a bodhisattva's meditation has no addiction to the taste of meditation. Meditation can be deeply pleasurable. Wonderful sort of blisses and ecstasies and peace and all the rest of it. It tastes very fine. But for a bodhisattva, he enjoys that taste, but he's not addicted to it. You know, he doesn't need that taste, if you like. He can enjoy, he can let it go. He can kiss the joy as it flies. There's no attachment. So there's a great openness. Great openness to what may arise. And sixthly, the bodhisattva's meditation is free from the notion of any object. In his meditation, there's no object of meditation at all. It doesn't mean he's spaced out. I mean, a lot of people talk about, I meditate without an object. And when they tell you what they do, they're just spacing out. You know, they're just running after sheep, you know, in their heads. That is not objectless meditation. A bodhisattva's objectless meditation is just, it's without object in the sense that he is open in the direction of reality, which is without a direction. So that's a bodhisattva's happy and blissful abiding in meditation, a deep, open and easy state of being, opening to the mysteries of things. So then Gampopa describes meditation that gives rise to good qualities, and here Gampopa refers to the different lists of freedoms and liberations and powers that open up, and in the commentaries you get great long lists of these that open up when you get deeply into meditation. And again, it's very important when you see these things. I mean, it can be incredibly discouraging to see them for a start. Oh my goodness, you know, I can't even count to 10. Can't even count to 5. It's not about that, I don't think, and it's not about forcing ourselves into these states, or, you know, that you'll get a certificate when you've attained a particular liberation. It's not about that. What I like about it, what I find inspiring about it, these things indicate the depths of meditation. I find that an inspiration, you know, just to have that as a backdrop. There are great depths that can open up, but you can't, you know, force yourself to have those things. Thirdly, the third aspect of a bodhisattva's meditation is meditation that benefit beings. And here something extraordinary is mentioned. Through very deep and profound meditation, deep absorption in wisdom and compassion, you can begin to create forms that go out to benefit beings. Weird, eh? I mean, we really are getting into some weird spaces now. Apparently, this is what great bodhisattvas and Buddhas can do. This is the tradition. They can kind of emanate forms that go out and do stuff. There's a contemporary account of this, I'd say contemporary, last century stuff. If you look in Lama Govinda's The Way of the White Clouds, he gives an account. People he spoke to of his teacher, Tomo Geshe Rinpoche, who kind of manifested a great vision, which everybody could see, of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. So if you want to And apparently there were even these kind of lotuses, great lotuses, that were kind of lying around on the ground. And if, but if you went to try and get them, they'd just vanish and things like that. Now, I know it all sounds a bit weird and wonderful and all the rest of it, but, and you'll go, oh, come on. But that is the tradition. I don't know about that. I can't say I've noticed that. But actually, I do believe that meditating can affect environments directly. I believe that meditation that can touch people, beings. I think there's a magical force and power in meditation in that sense. I mean, traditionally, the Metta-Bhavana practice is, yes, it is about transforming our behaviour, but it's actually about affecting the world as you sit, generating loving kindness. And the more deeply absorbed you are in that loving kindness, the more you can positively affect the people and the world around you. You can touch and influence and benefit others directly. I mean, have you ever noticed how if you put someone in your Metta-Bhavana practice, a neutral person, you know, you neither like them or dislike them, or somebody you really don't like, you put them in your Metta-Bhavana practice and it goes, you know, fairly well, let's say, somehow you end up meeting them and having a really good meeting with them. Sometimes they sort of come to you. It's really strange, and you know, something in forces, as it were, are being set up where you can touch people. Deep, mysterious things can happen when you meditate. I mean, people are very attracted to magic these days. You know, the whole Harry Potter series and all that sort of thing. And you know, we watch it and we enjoy it and all the rest of it. But hey, you know, you can do that magic. You know, when you sit and meditate. You know, when you generate skillful, positive states of mind that can actually touch the world. Anyway, whatever. The important thing to remember is those two aspects of meditation I've already mentioned. Shamatha, calm, abiding, stable, peace, tranquility. The mind resting within itself in pure absorption. That's the first aspect. And he's already described that. You develop this deeply calm and stable and broad, expansive being. That's what you're doing in meditation, a pure and open being. And it's on the basis of that that you cultivate the second great aspect of meditation, vipassana, clear seeing of the true nature of things, clear seeing that leads to wisdom, that leads to liberation. It's very important to emphasize this clear seeing is not having ideas about seeing. It's not having clear ideas. You might use the intellect within the context of that deep state of concentration that you develop. You might reflect in that space on the way things are. But in the end, real vipassana is a direct, unmediated apprehension with the whole of your being of things as they are. And you can only see that depending on the depth of your meditation. Without that, you know, you can't really see things as they are. So this brings us to the last of the perfections, the last of the paramitas, and this is prajna paramita, the perfection of wisdom. And Gampopa begins his section on wisdom with the following. No bodhisattva, though he have all the virtues, such as generosity and meditation, will reach the state of an enlightened one unless he possesses wisdom, because like a blind man without a guide, he cannot reach his destination. And he quotes a Buddhist text which says, how will a million, million blind men, or even more, ever enter a city not knowing a road to it? Without wisdom as their guide, the other perfections are blind, and enlightenment cannot be attained. It's wisdom that liberates. It's seeing things as they are that we need for liberation. Before then, no matter how developed we are, we can lose what we have gained. And that's why it's so important to keep up the spiritual effort until we've actually developed wisdom. So developing wisdom, developing seeing is crucial. But then Gampopa asks a very pertinent question. Why then if this wisdom is enough, should skillful means, expressed as generosity in the other perfections, be necessary? The answer is, wisdom on its own is not enough. So what he's saying here, we need to cultivate the other perfections, generosity and so on, which he's describing here as skillful means, upaya kaushalya. We need to develop those. We need, if you like, to build and develop our character, we could say, because wisdom on its own is not enough. We need to become a deeper and broader and richer being. That enables us to actually see reality. That enables us to develop the liberating wisdom. And also working on these other perfections means that we have something to give others. Working on these other perfections, we develop all sorts of skills and we bring all sorts of riches to benefit others so that they can connect with the way to liberation. This is why these other perfections, generosity and so on, are called skillful means. At the same time, without wisdom, all these other qualities are mundane, they're worldly. That can be the danger. You're just a good person, but you're not a liberated person, and you're not able to liberate. So we need both these things. We need the skillful means of generosity, ethics, patience, effort, and meditation, and we need the wisdom of the perfection of wisdom. We need both these things, says Gampopa, in order to attain nirvana. The true nirvana, and the true nirvana is called a pratishtitta nirvana. I like that phrase, which means the non-abiding nirvana, the nirvana where we're neither of the wheel nor we're off the wheel, the nirvana that's not in samsara or in nirvana, paradoxically. The great Bodhisattva Vimalakirti says, and Gampopa quotes this, what is a Bodhisattva's enslavement and what is his liberation? Wisdom, unsupported by skillful means, is enslavement. Skillful means, unsupported by wisdom, is enslavement. When both wisdom and skillful means are present, there is liberation. So this, when you get this kind of thing going on, this sort of description, you begin to realise what a mysterious figure the Bodhisattva is. He's, in the time-honoured phrase, he's in the world, but not of it, likened to a lotus. The roots are in the mud, but the lotus is free of the mud, untouched by the mud. Or it's sometimes said, and Gampopa would have known this text, that a bodhisattva is like a fire, constantly blazing up in work for others, like that great fire that we saw last night. Yet, he's always in the calm of meditation and formlessness. Gampopa also says that if you want to go somewhere, you need eyes and feet. The eyes are wisdom, the feet are the other perfections of generosity and so on. And he's very keen to make it clear that we really do need to generate the positive momentum of generosity and so on. So you're like a fire burning up obstacles. It's very important, this, because people want to rush to insight, to wisdom. We get very impatient for this sort of thing. We want a big experience that will sort everything out. We want the big, the great bliss, ecstatic freedom moment where we've got it all sussed and we're all powerful. Of course we do. But it doesn't work like that. And if you try to do it like that, well, maybe you will see something, but you'll get unhinged in the scene. It'll crack you up. Or you'll just get disappointed and you'll react to it. You know, we can't grow and unfold if we take this approach to things. Enlightenment, after all, is not an experience. It's not a thing to possess, to have and to own. The Buddha describes it as profound, subtle, peaceful, not reachable by thought. And trying to force something to happen Well, that becomes unsustainable if we practice like that. There is that, well, there can be this incongruence that I talked about earlier between our being, our life, and the way things are. So we need to start healing that split between our being, our life, and the way things are. And we do that by working on our whole life, on our character. Then we might begin to see. We will also have more to give people. This is, of course, the stuff of stories in all sorts of tradition of master and apprentice, master and disciple. The apprentice, the disciple, wants the special magic knowledge that will fix everything and make him all powerful. But the wise master teaches him in all sorts of strange ways to build and deepen and develop his character. That all has to be built up before there's the liberating wisdom. So, having said all that, how to develop this wisdom? And again, Gampopa is very thorough indeed. And he covers wisdom really with the remaining chapters. Well, particularly with the Perfection of Wisdom chapter and the Buddhahood chapter. And again, it's impossible to explore everything. One thing he says almost in passing is that wisdom, cultivating wisdom, perfecting wisdom, includes learning in the so-called worldly subjects, medicine, logic, linguistics, art, that sort of thing. So it's very important, this, that Buddhism isn't down on the great achievements of human culture. In fact, depictions of the ideal Bodhisattva describe him as a master of all dharmas, of all things. The picture you get is of somebody cultured and broad, so able to connect with many people. And Sangharakshita, our own teacher, even believes as an idea, I think it's an experience for him, that the arts, a deep appreciation of and engagement with the arts, can lead to the profoundest wisdom. So Gampopa also mentions in passing, more than once, the three kinds of wisdom. So this is important. There's the wisdom of hearing. So this is the wisdom that comes when you study the Buddhist texts, when you get the teachings clearly into your mind. You're clear about what they are and what they mean. You've just got them in consciousness. And then there's the wisdom that comes through contemplating those ideas, if you like. You reflect on them, you turn them over in your mind, you see their implications, you connect them to your life. And then the third level of wisdom is making those things a living experience through your reflection in the context of your overall spiritual practice. You see directly, you know directly, they're not an idea anymore. You see, you live the plain sense of things. For this is what wisdom is. This is the basic definition: seeing things as they really are. Last week I mentioned Milarepa, Gampopa's teacher, seeing his pot break, his only possession, his lovely old clay pot where he'd always cooked his nettle broth, and you just saw it rolling down the mountain and smashing. And in that moment, he saw directly impermanence as a reality, not as an idea, as a reality. And he praises the pot as his teacher, as his guru, teaching impermanence. Well, he could only see that because of his deep and intensive spiritual practice, which would have included meditation and a deep pondering on the teachings, and before that, much arduous service to his teacher, Marpa. And Gampopa describes the many ways in which one ponders and meditates on the teachings regarding wisdom, and it would be quite impossible to explore really any of these here, but I can say they involve gaining a clear insight into the truth that nowhere in the whole of existence, in ourselves, in things, from atoms to universes, nowhere is there a permanent, a separate, a fixed entity such as a soul, a self, or an essential stuff. Everything, and internally and externally, is shunyata, emptiness. And Gampopa's chapter is concerned really with the realisation of just this. And of course, by shunyata, he doesn't mean nothingness. He doesn't mean a blank, grey vacuum. He's very, very concerned to refute that idea. And he quotes the Indian tantric magician Saraha, who says rather bluntly, "Those who believe in real existence are stupid, like cattle. But those who believe in non-existence are still more stupid." So those who get this notion of shunyata, emptiness, wrong, are also said to be people who can't be helped. They've made the medicine into poison. You can meet people who tell you, "Nothing's really there, man. It's all an illusion, man. There's nothing really matters, man. Pass us a joint, mate." You know, they're sort of dull and spaced out, and there's this incredible conceit that goes with it. Have you ever met people like that? They kind of come out with this stuff, and this extraordinary kind of conceit that goes with it. You know, if they were ice creams, they'd lick themselves. Sorry, I don't wear that. Anyway, so it's not that, okay? It's not that. Perhaps the best way to gain a feeling for what seeing shunyata might be comes when Gampopa quotes from the Samadhi Raja Sutra, very famous sutra, Buddhist text, where the Buddha says, "Just as a magician produces visible objects such as horses, elephants, carts, and other things, which though they appear, are non-existent, so you should experience the whole of reality." This magician's illusion is a famous metaphor in this tradition. India, apparently, ancient India was famous for its magicians, you know, who kind of turn up in the local village and conjure up an incredible scene of elephants and warfare and people being murdered and killed, and it's all very scary, and then they'd kind of dissolve it away. So the point here is, when we see shunyata, things and people don't disappear. We see them as maya, which in the Buddhist context is translated as illusion. But maya can also mean creative display. It's one of the words for art. You know, in art, you're creating. You know, there's this wonderful creative display, a magical display. So it's all there. Everything is there. This room is here, and we, the people in it, are here. But it's brilliant, beautiful, luminous, arising and passing away. There is no permanent and separated out entities in any of it. Now, we have to be careful, because the metaphor breaks down, because Buddhism doesn't say there's a magician, some cosmic magician behind all this, doing all this. That's where the metaphor breaks down. It just says there is just this wonderful, creative, magical display. That's us. That's the world we're in. Everything is transparent. There is no ultimate distinction between self and other, and self and things. In one Buddhist tradition, they use the metaphor that in reality, everything is made of different beams of coloured light, transparent and intersecting one another. So all the meditations that Gampopa describes are ways to get to this insight, to open up to this insight. Once our own teacher, Sangharakshita, in trying to give us a way into this without misunderstanding, because you can appreciate this way of talking about things, you know, is tricky. But trying to give us a way into this, he spoke of wisdom, of the perfection of wisdom, in terms of appreciative awareness. He pointed out that in awareness, in wisdom, there's an aesthetic quality. There's a quality of aesthetic awareness, by which he means seeing people and things as they are in themselves, not in terms of how we can use them and manipulate them. We see them without grasping, without clinging, without a self, even. So the best way into this, perhaps, to approach this way of looking at things is look for beauty, look for the beautiful. And this is especially emphasised in the Metta Bhavana practice. If you are dwelling in metta, in that clean and clear loving kindness. You see everyone and everything as the beautiful. And when you're deeply absorbed in that, you have the sense that there is no self and other. The barriers, the divisions dissolve. They're there, but they're sort of transparent. It's all a wonderful and magical display. And there's a sense that you and all beings and all things are completely permeable. The Heart Sutra puts it succinctly, form is emptiness. Emptiness is form. And the effect of this realization, Gampopa says, is not only the attainment of Buddhahood, and he gives a very rich description of that, but Buddha activity. And this is the final chapter of his book. Buddha activity, which is spontaneous activity to benefit others. Because you have this insight, this wisdom, this awareness of the true nature of things, because a Buddha does, his natural way of being is to naturally and spontaneously provide everyone he encounters with the means to liberation. Buddha activity is, as the Zen tradition has it, entering the marketplace with bliss-bestowing hands. And the description of this stage in the Zen tradition is that a man in this who's reached this stage of entering the marketplace in bliss-bestowing hands, who sees everything as this wonderful magical display, he can speak any language. He can talk to anybody. The poem says in this tradition, he can speak Mongolian. He can speak Chinese. He can tune into anybody. And he behaves as he pleases. And without bothering to perform miracles, bear trees naturally burst into blossom. So this is the freedom. This is the liberation into the spontaneity of wisdom and loving kindness that is the endless end of all Buddhist practice. And this is the liberation that Gampopa offers us in the Jewel Ornament of Liberation.